I'm J.G. Michael, and this is Parallax Views.
Hello, this is Mike Swanson, and in a few moments, you're going to listen to another segment of Parallax Views. But before you do that, let me tell you about my new book, Why the Vietnam War. It's a sequel to my previous book called The War State, which has lots of positive reviews and Amazon's been out for years. But this one is a more detailed case study of how American Empire and National Security State operate using Vietnam. And I believe it shows also how things work today, how policy is actually made and why. So grab the book on Amazon.com, Why the Vietnam War.
Hey there, Parallax Views listeners. On this edition of the program, we'll be continuing our exploration of the Israel-Palestine conflict. Now, as of this recording, news has just broke that a ceasefire has been announced. Despite this, I feel we should not allow the latest chapter in this conflict to go down the memory hole. And furthermore, in my view, we should be using this opportunity to understand the conflict and its history more broadly. Joining us to help with that task is Phyllis Bennis, an expert on the Middle East, working for the Institute for Policy Studies. Bennis is also the author of an excellent book entitled Understanding the Palestinian-Israeli Conflict, a Primer. If you're new to this conflict and trying to make sense of it all, I think you'll be very interested in this short but sweet conversation as we discuss the nature of the occupation in Gaza, human rights violations taking place there right now, the changing nature of U.S. public opinion when it comes to the Israel-Palestine conflict, and the history of the special relationship between the United States and Israel. All that and much more on this edition of Parallax Views, and now onto the conversation with Phyllis Bennis of the Institute for Policy Studies and author of Understanding the Palestinian-Israeli Conflict, a Primer. Washington, D.C., place of stately discourse.
Bare knuckle politics and all other assorted forms of scandal. You want that dirt on the Capitol? Then check out Washington Babylon. Shocking true stories and political sleaze, edited by Ken Silverstein. WashingtonBabylon.com.
Welcome to Parallax Views, Phyllis Bennis, director of the New Internationalism Project at the Institute for Policy Studies.
How are you? Thanks very much. Great to be with you.
So I wanted to have you on because you are really an expert on the Middle East and the Israel-Palestine conflict. What do you make of the latest developments when it comes to Israel, the airstrikes in Gaza? What are the main things that people should really be thinking about right now?
Well, I think one of the most important is the recognition that this is not a situation of both sides. Both sides should de-escalate. Both sides are responsible. No one benefits from this. That's not the case. This is not maybe Peru and Ecuador in a border dispute. This is an occupied population facing an illegal occupation where the occupier, Israel, is by far the most powerful military force in the region and has the backing of the strongest and wealthiest country in the world, the United States. And the Palestinians have not only no functioning government because they have no power, they have no control of their own borders, no control of their own airspace, their waters, their electrical grid, their ability to say who comes in or out of their territories, no contiguity, nothing. That's what we're dealing with. So, you know, you could imagine if the fighting stopped today and Hamas disappeared, Gaza would still be essentially a open-air prison for 2 million people, half of whom are children, and 80% of whom are so poor that they depend for basic food on international support. The people living in the West Bank would still be living under military occupation, with settlers given carte blanche to steal their land, carry out atrocities against Palestinians, and be defended by the court system. And crucially, you would still have apartheid, a very carefully chosen term because it, not because it's so much like South Africa, it's not really like South Africa at all, but because it's a system of two or more separate legal systems in one territory controlled by one power, which is Israel, where people are treated differently based on issues of race, ethnicity, religion, etc. That's the definition of apartheid. All of that is the basis on which the immediate crisis erupted. And, you know, you can pick a time. It's like, well, it started when Hamas sent rockets. Well, okay, and what was happening an hour before they sent rockets that led to the rockets being sent? You know, there's an old saying, history is determined by when you start the clock. And I think that's a very important concept for those of us who tend to only hear mainstream media reports when Israelis are at risk. Palestinians living under occupation, living in the besieged Gaza Strip with no sufficient access to water, sufficient food, medical care, they're at risk every day. And we don't hear about it so much. We hear about it when there is a violent response to that. And Israelis are at risk, which is, of course, its own violation of international law, but it doesn't come out of nowhere. It comes out of a reality that people have been living for 50 years.
And I was going to add to that, I think, you know, people can condemn Hamas firing rockets, but that doesn't mean we can't also condemn when Israeli airstrikes are killing civilians, including children.
Well, that's certainly true. I would say that it's also an obligation of us because, unlike other struggles in the world, the United States is directly complicit in this one. We give the Israeli military, not the people of Israel, the Israeli military, $3.8 billion of our tax money every year. No questions asked, no restrictions, no conditionalities, no requirements like every other country that gets military aid for human rights requirements, nothing. They can do with it as they like. And we have an obligation to put a stop to that. You know, it's not just about, well, it's great that we condemn Hamas and we should also condemn Israel. It's not about condemnation. It's about where do we have obligations because of the role of our government. Very directly, we elect governments over and over again. And they differ on policy issues, they differ on language, but they don't disagree so far. And we're hearing it in the reluctance of the Biden administration, despite this extraordinary shift of the discourse in Congress, where the Biden administration and President Biden himself just will not say the words, even there's going to be an immediate ceasefire or you are going to lose your access to U.S. military aid. It's all he needs to say, and there would be a ceasefire. This notion of saying, well, we support a ceasefire, we would support a ceasefire, is giving Israel the right to decide when there should be a ceasefire. You know, that's not support for a ceasefire, and that's not using the leverage that $3.8 billion a year in military aid gives to our government.
I also, since we mentioned the term occupation, I'm going to be talking to John DeGarde later, and I've also spoken to Richard Falk, both of whom were, for my listeners, the UN Special Rapporteurs on the Occupied Territories. When we talk about occupation, this isn't even a normal occupation. This has been going on longer than most occupations.
Exactly. And military law that governs occupations, particularly the Geneva Conventions, and this is something that both John and Richard have written about in their extraordinary important reports during their periods as the special rapporteurs. We need new definitions in international law for what appear to be permanent occupations. At a certain point, it's no longer an occupation. You now have something like 750,000 Israeli Jews living in occupied East Jerusalem and the occupied West Bank who are violating international law every morning just by getting out of bed because they are living on illegally expropriated land. Period, full stop. That should mean something different than a temporary occupation during a moment of war, and then the occupation ends and people who either were driven out or fled in terror are allowed to come back to rebuild their homes, even if there's a different government in charge of the land where their homes were. Palestinians were never allowed the right to return to their homes, not those who were driven out, the 750,000 who were driven out in the war of 1947-48 that Israelis call their war of independence and Palestinians call the Nakba or the catastrophe, and not the 250,000 more who were driven out in 1967 from their homes and their land. None of them have been allowed to return. And yet, Israel has this other law. It's not the right of return for the Palestinians who were actually displaced, but what they call the law of return, which says that Jews anywhere in the world, Jews like me, whose families have no ties to anything in the Middle East, my family all came from parts of Russia, and they had been there as long as anybody can remember. We have the right to show up at the airport and claim instant citizenship. There's nothing just about that. There's nothing fair about that. There should be nothing legal about that. And in fact, that disparity is one of the components of the crime of apartheid defined by Human Rights Watch and by the Israeli human rights organization, B'Tselem. So this notion of permanent occupation has become a whole new category, but there's no new accountability for Israel. It has certainly just for 50 years now been allowed to continue this continued military occupation of the West Bank, Gaza, and East Jerusalem. And we should note that Gaza, even with the withdrawal of the withdrawal of Israeli troops and settlers from the territory of Gaza, Gaza is still an occupied population, because the definition of occupation is not how many soldiers are on your territory. It's who has control. Israel controls everything in the lives of people of Gaza, down to the amount of calories per day they will be allowed to eat. That was a debate in the Israeli in the Israeli cabinet several years ago, when one member of the cabinet notably said, "We don't want to starve them to death. We just want to sort of put them on a diet." It was an extraordinary thing to say. So what enters the territory? Are they going to allow the materials to rebuild the water treatment plant? Apparently not, because it hasn't been rebuilt since 2014. Are we going to allow in all the medicines they need? No, because people die of cancer because they can't get chemotherapy drugs. You know, this is ultimate control. That's what occupation means. And that's been going on unchallenged by the U.S. government, other than rhetorically, for 52 years.
So I'm glad you mentioned the Human Rights Watch report and the B'Tselem report. I feel like those could be game changers. At the same time, I've seen people also react saying, you know, we've heard about game changers before. Maybe we shouldn't be so quick to say that this time it's different. How would you respond to people that have just become maybe even cynical about just this whole conflict, that are saying, well, there's not going to be a change. We haven't seen it before. We're not going to see it now. Do you think we could be going in the right direction, or is it going to be more of the same?
I think we are in an entirely new period. I don't think any single report, not the Human Rights Watch report, not B'Tselem, not any single report, not the special rapporteur reports from John Dugard or Richard Falk, none of those things by themselves are a game changer. The game changer has been the 25 years or more of organizing across the United States and certainly globally, but we're talking here about the role of the US government. So we're talking about organizing in the United States, of an extraordinary movement for Palestinian rights. It's taken all kinds of different forms, protesting military aid to Israel, the BDS campaign, which is a way of bringing nonviolent economic pressure to bear on Israel to stop its violations of international law, mobilizations by Palestinian communities across the United States. All of these have played a role in what we're seeing now, this amazing shift in the discourse, public discourse. You know, you look at the polls and you see this extraordinary level of shifting around from a period when I was a Jewish kid in Los Angeles growing up. Nobody questioned support for Israel. Certainly Jews growing up in Los Angeles, that was our whole definition. We didn't really talk about God. We talked about Israel. That was what it meant to be Jewish, right? Young Jewish kids now growing up are joining organizations like Jewish Voice for Peace, If Not Now, Open Hillel, all these amazing organizations challenging support for Israel. Some are explicitly anti-Zionist. Some don't take a particular position, but are very critical of the occupation. It's an amazing time. You see it becoming a partisan issue in a way it never was before. You know, this notion that Israel was, support for Israel was always something that everybody agreed with. Well, not anymore. We don't see the shift as big yet in Congress, or certainly not in the White House. That's coming, but that's more a slow process. The quicker process is on the voters. A new poll just came out just a week or two ago, and I don't remember the exact numbers, but essentially, support for Israel from Democrats is down in the low 20s. Among Republicans, and it's in the high 60s. That's an incredible divide. And at some point, members of Congress are going to realize that not only is it not political suicide to criticize Israel, but we're moving towards a moment when it's going to be political suicide not to criticize Israel, not to be willing to vote against military aid, not to support the new resolution that Betty McCollum has put forward, that calls for protection of Palestinian children, making sure that U.S. military aid is not used for the Israeli juvenile military detention system. Israel is the only country in the world that has a military detention system for children as young as 12. Only Palestinian children, of course, not their own children, not Israeli children, but for Palestinian children. So this is an amazing time with incredible shifts underway in the discourse. And eventually, it's not like our democracy is so great that once the people want something, that's what happens in Washington. I'm not naive enough to think that. But it does have an impact. And over time, people that are running for office are going to find out that money that comes from pro-Israel lobbies, whether it's the traditional Jewish lobbies like AIPAC, or if it's the newer but very, very powerful Christian lobbies like Kufi, Christians United for Israel, that they can still get money from those organizations, or they might get, you know, the threat that if they don't toe the line, that those organizations might fund their opponents. But they don't bring the voters anymore. And at the end of the day, members of Congress have to be elected. State assembly people have to be elected. The money goes to getting votes. But at the end of the day, if you can't get the votes, the money doesn't matter.
Before we close out here, I think some people will still say, well, we can't be so critical of Israel. There's a special relationship between the U.S. and Israel. What is with that special relationship? And, you know, do you think that maybe we need to have more normal relations like we do with other countries?
You know, that's a very important question. And the second part of it in particular, no one ever asks, why do we treat Israel differently than every other country? Those of us who are critics of Israel, those of us who support Palestinian rights, are very often accused of a double standard, that we treat Israel differently than every other country. Why aren't you criticizing Saudi Arabia? And my answer to that is, oh, I didn't see you at the protest at the Saudi embassy last week. Did you not get the memo? You know, because most of them are really not dealing with any other country's human rights violations. But the irony is, of course, that it's the United States government since 1967, not since 48, but since 67, has treated Israel in this whole different way, this so-called special relationship. And that relationship started as a military relationship. It started not because of support for Israel among U.S. Jews or the U.S. community in general. It started after the Six-Day War, when the Pentagon looked at the result of that war that Israel won so quickly and so decisively in such a short time, and said, wow, these guys are good. We could do business with these people. And military business became the basis of that special relationship. And over the years, there's been this two-part level of consolidation of that relationship, the political relationship led by these lobby groups with broad public support for a long time until the last 15 or 20 years when it began to change, that talk about Israel as the sole democracy in the region, et cetera, et cetera. And on the other hand, the military relationship, where Israel for many years during the Cold War acted as a cat's paw of U.S. intervention around the world. So if you went to, say, Guatemala, when it became politically not so expedient for the U.S. to continue supporting the Guatemalan military junta that was slaughtering native Guatemalans, indigenous people in the highlands, they turned to Israel to become the main supplier of weapons. And the Israeli rifle, the Galil, became the most popular rifle in the Guatemalan military. So you have examples like that. You have the role of Israel in Africa, where they were challenging progressive liberation movements fighting for independence. And Israel joined the U.S. in providing arms, providing training, et cetera, as well as in the region itself, in the Middle East, of course. So in those years, in the Cold War years, the military side, the strategic relationship, was actually primary. The political relationship bolstered that primary part. When the Cold War ended, that sort of shifted briefly. And suddenly Israel was not such a strategic necessity anymore. And at that point, the political side, the lobbies, et cetera, they were what emerged much more powerfully than the strategic relationship. That period didn't last very long. But as soon as the so-called global war on terror was announced, right after the 9/11 terror attacks, and the Bush administration said the answer to this crime is going to be to take the whole world to war, suddenly Israel becomes the crucial ally again. The strategic side takes over. And in fact, on the day of the 9/11 attacks, Bibi Netanyahu, who was, I think, then already prime minister, he was not prime minister yet, I think, at that time. But he said publicly, good, when he was told about the attacks, he said, good, now they'll know how we feel, something like that. And it was that first word when he said, good. And then he pulled back and said, well, not good. But it was clear that was what he believed, that this was going to be good for Israel, because now Israel would again have the pride of place as the strategic ally. And that's what we've been seeing ever since.
So the final question here, and this is a little bit of a two-parter, if we could real quick. First, to those who are listening that, you know, may feel like, oh, I don't know enough of the history, and the usual sort of response is given for why people don't want to take stances on this conflict. What would you say to them? And also for the people that really want to make a difference, what would you say they need to do?
Well, for the first group, people in this country generally think they know a lot, because we learn a lot about Israel from kindergarten right through the end of high school and into university. So people do know a lot. A lot of what they know is wrong, frankly. But the problem is, you don't have to know the whole history to know that when you have this kind of disparity of power, you don't have to deal with issues of settler colonialism and apartheid if you're not sort of willing to think about that yet. Just look at the question of collective punishment that Israel is imposing in Gaza, even before the current bombing, the denial of access to food, the denial of the right to move, to travel, to leave where you live and return to it. That should be enough for people to say, this is not okay. We should not be funding for that. We should not be paying for that. That should be enough. For people who want to work, there's a huge amount to be done. The BDS movement, Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions, is still active, looking at nonviolent pressure being brought to bear on Israel, as I mentioned earlier. There are huge new campaigns focusing on congressional bills. The bill I mentioned earlier that Betty McCollum has introduced, it's House Bill 2590. call your member of Congress and urge them to sign that bill that would impose end-use restrictions on military aid so it cannot be used to pay for arresting and detaining children, 12-year-olds, in military prisons. And there's a new bill that was just introduced today by Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez with a group of about, I think, about 15 other members of Congress. Very short bill that simply says that the announcement from the White House recently that they are about to approve, that they had approved, a new sale of $735 million worth of missile packages to the Israeli military right now in the midst of this assault on Gaza, that that's not acceptable and it should be prohibited. Call your member of Congress again, urge them, demand that they support that bill. It would be a joint bill between the House and the Senate. It's very important that there be a strong showing of support for those moves in Congress. Congress is moving in a whole new way, and it's very important that they see that there's public support for those shifts.
Well, I want to thank you, Phyllis Bennis, for coming on Parallax Views, and hopefully we can have you on again when we have a little bit more time. There's so many issues to cover. Thank you once again.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Well, that does it for this edition of Parallax Views. I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Phyllis Bennis of the Institute for Policy Studies, and I really recommend picking up a copy of Understanding the Palestinian-Israeli Conflict, a Primer, if you'd like to get a firmer grasp on the topics we discussed on this edition of the program. As always, let me know what you thought about this edition of Parallax Views by dropping me a line on Twitter at ViewsParallax or by email at parallaxviewspod@protonmail.com. Producers credit shoutouts to Catherine, Nathan, Holland, Mark, Chase, Zach, Omar, Ted, Ryan, Gratz, Martin, Gary, Emilia, and Mickey. If you'd like your very own producer's credit on each and every edition of Parallax Views, well, consider joining those listeners in supporting me at the $10 or $15 tiers of my Patreon page at patreon.com/parallaxviews. That's patreon.com/parallaxviews. There is also a $1 tier and a $5 tier. Any amount will help. Your support is what keeps this show going. So if you appreciate the work I do, $1, $5, $10, $15, doesn't matter. Please consider supporting me on Patreon at patreon.com/parallaxviews. Again, that's patreon.com/parallaxviews. And with that being said, until next time, you've been listening to Parallax Views with Parallax Views. To Parallax Views with Parallax Views.
The way out is not simply to say don't do it, just to prohibit. It's nothing else. If we don't do it, others will be doing it like crazy. So, you know, we have to confront the problem. But no, basically, I know of the great anxiety problems, new forms of control, but it's also new forms of freedom. This is why I always emphasize that internet and all this new digital stuff, it's a very ambiguous phenomenon, but it's the field of struggle. New forms of enslavement, but at the same time, new incredible forms of freedom. We have to accept the fight with no nostalgia for old, allegedly more authentic communities or whatever. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid.